Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, my name is Bruce Norris. Thank you for joining us. Today, once again, our guest is Sean O'Toole, founder and CEO of ForeclosureRadar.com. Sean has been an experienced trustee sale investor, buying over 150 properties, both residential and commercial. And he has a very intensive tech background that he has brought to ForeclosureRadar.com. Sean, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
We had just started touching on the term shadow inventory, and originally it meant the lenders had foreclosed on inventory and they were sitting on it. And now what does that term mean to you, the shadow inventory?
Well, I still think of it as being that how we originally coined it, of being the bank-owned homes. And, you know, we were the first to say there's no more shadow inventory, that those bank-owned homes that the banks were appear to be sitting on in late 2008 are largely gone now. But it's been pretty universally extended to also include those in the foreclosure process still, not yet bank-owned, and even those that have not been making their payments. From there, I've even heard a few, which I definitely don't agree with, extended to those folks that are underwater or even to those folks who would want to sell their house today if prices were back at 2006 levels, which I think is really overextending the term.
Yeah, that's everybody, right?
Right.
But I guess the term shadow inventory, I'm thinking what most people will think about is there a ball turning behind the scenes that could emerge and affect the pricing? I think that is a valid concern. So whether the banks own it yet or not, is there some inevitability about the process that they will eventually own it, or are they really now going to concentrate so much on every other way to dispose of it, as in let's sell a million houses to somebody that's going to keep them as rentals and keep the occupant in it, or, you know, deed in lieu? You know, what's your take on what percentage of this will be solved without the process of a trustee sale?
Well, except for the word solved, I think we're going to see every possible effort to not go to trustee sale. I think we'll see these REO rentals or even deed in lieu rentals where they basically say, hey, give us the deed to your house and we'll rent it back to you. I think we'll see every possible thing in the book to keep these things going from foreclosure. Unfortunately, it's one of these interesting things where you've got Occupy Wall Street and others all rallying against foreclosure. And what I don't think they realize is that they're helping the banks, right? Foreclosures hurt the banks, and foreclosures are the best thing ever, especially in California, for the consumer, right? You get to completely walk away from the debt with a 7-year hit on your credit in most cases. And, you know, it's a brilliantly pro-consumer thing. And it's been turned on its head by some activists to be anti-consumer. And remind me to tell you one particular story about that. But, but I think that's absolutely the trend. We've seen that trend since, you know, September of 2008 when Paulson announced TARP. And I think every government action, every program we've seen since then, even robo-signing in the Attorney General's settlement, which some people see as going to free the foreclosures up, I think have been specifically designed to provide cover to the bank to allow them to continue to trickle this out and manage their losses and manage their balance sheets. Sorry, long-winded answer.
No, that's okay. It's you have a tendency to be right. But, you know, one of the things that's – I don't know that there's much that's – new, deed in lieu, for instance, that's been around for several years. And I would say you could probably count them on not too many hands, the ones that have actually been accomplished. So originally I thought that was probably a reasonable way to do it, but it has been received by the occupant with a yawn. Why do you think that is?
Well, and it wasn't just a problem with the occupant. I think it was mostly early on a problem with the lenders, in that the lenders, you know, when you take a deed in lieu, you take the risk for any junior debt. But I think what most of the big banks are maybe now figuring out, and this is just a suspicion on my part, is that if I'm Bank of America and there's a first and a second, you know, that first mortgage I've sold off to some investors. The second mortgage, you know, I hold myself as a portfolio loan. So if I take a deed in lieu, it certainly hurts the investor because it doesn't go through the foreclosure process and wipe out the second. But it sure leaves me as the second mortgage holder in a much better position. So a deed in lieu with a rental and then some sort of scheme that says someday this second mortgage may still be worth something if we hold on to this property long enough, and finding a way to make that all work on the books, pretty brilliant. If you're a banker, so I think we may see. I think we may see a renewed push there, and we just saw Bank of America announce that they are going to start a deed in lieu to rental program, which previously they've resisted.
You know, we have a portfolio of loans that I use the term that the Norris Group is the servicer, but we would never think of doing something without the express permission of the person that is actually the owner of the loan. And we would, you know, it seems like the servicer has, in some cases, more power than the people that actually own the loan. Is that a misinterpretation?
Which is why it's so important if you're an investor to carefully pick your servicer. And why, you know, and I think that's a testament to why people pick you and not others.
I mean, honestly, I didn't, you know, this is being naive, but I'm being honest. I'm thinking, okay, well, so what? You're a servicer. You can't do a thing without calling the person that's the Benny. But it sounds like maybe that somewhere in the contract, they've been given an awful lot of authority to act on behalf of the Benny. And boy, that's an interesting scenario where do you think that, okay, I'm going to act on your behalf for my interest. That's kind of a scary scenario.
You know, I've only dug into the Attorney General's settlement just a little bit, but I've talked to others who have, and they said one of the things that really surprised them and one of the things that's leading now to some investor lawsuits is there's things in the settlement that basically, you know, the servicers have agreed to put the investors in a worse position than their own portfolio seconds, right? So part of the settlement agreement was to give seconds a bigger share, right, in the names of helping homeowners. But,
wow,
you know, it sure seems like a bank bailout to me by any other name.
Up until recently, everybody's been against reducing principal. So there's been a couple of million loan mods, but really very few of them have dealt with principal reductions. And all of a sudden, that seems to be on the table as well. What are your thoughts on that?
You know, I think that's I think if they were really seriously talking about principal reductions, they would change the rules around mark to model, and they would change the rules around allowing which back to what they used to be, around allowing lenders to leave these things on their books for an extended period of time. You know, because if they couldn't play games and they had to take losses, then I think they'd realize principal balance reductions likely lead to lower losses. But they lead to losses, you know, all the same. And, you know, there's a tough double-edged sword because for every loan that's currently delinquent, there's another 3 to 4 folks that are underwater. So if you make that too easy, those other 3 to 4 that are underwater but still paying may want the same deal. And I personally think that leads to a banking collapse, you know, a la 2008, if not worse. And so I think this is the key reason DeMarco at FHFA, you know, has been pushing back against that is, you know, it's the start of a slippery slope. So I think it's getting more press. I don't know that we'll see really many more of them in reality.
It kind of reminds me of the $8,000 tax rebate because right before that, there was a $7,500 tax loan that was not a rebate. So you got an interest-free mm-hmm. loan. So if you had gotten the $7,500, you know, no-interest loan, and a month later the program changed, you, instead of feeling grateful, you are now feeling that you got cheated. Well, you can. Right. There's 2.2 million loan mods looking at this going, hey, we didn't get any principal reduction. So the first 2 million problems are people that have already gotten the loan mods.
Well, we've always called that first set of loan mods the most exotic loans ever made. I mean, here you're taking loans that already never should have probably been made at the first place.
Right.
And a lot of them get converted into these ridiculously low 2% interest rates, interest only for 5 years or some other incredible terms. Especially those early loan mods have just got to be some of the most toxic loans on the planet. And I think they're going to start blowing up as we hit the 5 year mark on those. I guess this is one reason I think this, you know, foreclosure problem is going to extend. It's something we used to talk about, you know, when the pay option arms or the 5-1 interest onlys, right? Remember, we used to track real carefully when these things would hit their reset dates.
Yeah.
And everybody's kind of forgotten about reset dates because they never panned out to matter as much as people thought, right? The things with reset dates were the ones the banks were most aggressive about fixing. But they fixed them, you know, by just tacking another 5 years onto an already bad deal in a lot of cases. And I think that's a ticking time bomb still. Coming back to your shadow inventory, you know, there's no question there's a lot of distress. The only thing that I try to remind folks is, with the length of the foreclosure process, you know, even if they got to work on it now and went through the foreclosure process as fast as possible, you know, by the time these things hit the market and they deal with the eviction and all the rest, you're talking a minimum of a year. And there's no sign of it at this point. So there's no possibility of a wave of foreclosures hurting the market in any way, shape, or form for at least 12 months. There's just not the inventory there that they could put back on the market that quickly.
Interesting. Okay. The loan mods that they did in the first year, whatever year that was, those are over 70% delinquent already. So
yeah.
Their total percentage of current loan mods for the entire history is 49%. So half of those are late. So if that was a loan program, it would be hard to call that a success, 50% default.
You know, it just should not have been any surprise. You can't take a toxic loan, make it more toxic, and think you've fixed it.
Just put it off. You said something I do want to clarify, because I think this is one of the things that people believe to be true. And what you said is true, but lenders will also loan to people in foreclosure much earlier than the 7-year time period you mentioned. So when somebody's in foreclosure, you had mentioned it's going to be on their credit history for 7 years, but that really doesn't prevent them from getting a loan for 7 years, correct?
No, absolutely not. And we actually think, you know, on the upside, you know, for the real estate market, you know, the folks that were foreclosed on early in 2008, you know, they're going to be 4 years into this. I think, you know, some of those folks are probably tired of being renters by now, realize that interest rates are awfully low, you know, are maybe starting to reach a point where they can qualify to be homeowners again. And we think that actually is a potential source of strength for the market in the next couple of years.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. And it's interesting. We interviewed FHA one time, and this was a couple of years ago, and I'm assuming it was a knowledgeable person that we had understanding their policies. And I asked her specifically the question, how long does it take after a foreclosure or bankruptcy before you'll consider me for a loan? And her answer really surprised me, 6 months. And I thought, well, that's certainly not the street answer. And sometimes there's overlays on top of programs. But if that program actually does exist, where a lender, where FHA would actually say, we will look at that as early as 6 months, then they really should think about knocking off the overlays, because it probably is a safe loan at this point. But, you know.
Yeah. If government hadn't outlawed everybody but big banks making loans and getting a decent return on their money, to homeowners. I personally would take any dollars that I had and loan it to strategic defaulters, right? Because these are folks that made financially smart, you know, decisions.
Mm-hmm.
And if I'm comfortable with current asset values, right, which I would not have been, I wouldn't have loaned a dime in 2006, 2007, but at these current price points in many areas, you know, I'd make a loan to anybody with a pulse. Because even if they didn't perform, you know, I could rent the property and get a better return than I'd probably get on the interest rate on the loan. And I could certainly find somebody else to take over that loan. And, you know, it's just crazy to me. You and I have talked about this. You know, they would make loans to anybody with a pulse when prices were ridiculously high. And now the prices are at a point where you're taking no risk by making a loan to anyone with a pulse. They won't do it.
You know, you and I had the privilege of going back to Washington, D.C. and sitting in front of what seemed to be pretty intelligent people. And you just wonder, okay, well, how is the decision process flawed where these people who are sitting in front of us, you know, like the gentleman from FHA, seem like a very honest, knowledgeable guy. You just think, okay, well, can't he have an influence? And it seems like if it was the decision that he could make, he would make the same one that you and I have just talked about, you know, maybe becoming a little bit aggressive and lending to people and all that. But it seems like there's roadblocks to common sense there.
Well, I came home from that trip more depressed than I had been in my adult life.
You know, well, the only reason I came home a little bit better than that is I always realized there would be room for private money.
Yeah, right. It's actually good for your business.
Exactly.
That they're insane.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, you know, they continue to make lending money privately as illegal as possible to help out their handful of friends at the banks. But fortunately, they haven't done that for loans to investors. They've left just some room. But,
yeah. Well,
hopefully that stays true.
Well, and what you said is just very important. When you look at things as a business owner, one of the scariest things is that you feel like things could change at the drop of a hat and for all the wrong reasons. So, you know, when you talk about foreclosures that have all everything behind everything that's real should have foreclosures going up. And the reality is 2012 is going to probably play out just as you suspect with the quantity getting into the marketplace with less inventory. And
but just to put this in perspective, right on that point, the less in February, we saw fewer foreclosure sales than any month since September of 2007. Now, the number of people underwater, the number of people in the foreclosure process is not that dramatically different from when we were near our peak
right.
in foreclosure sales. That was three times as many. But clearly, the only difference between then and now, we've worked through some, but the big difference between then and now is the policies around foreclosures. And I'd love to say those policies were helping folks with principal balance, loan mods, and, you know, a lot more short sales. We certainly have some more short sales, but, you know, that's not the reality.
You track a couple of other states, and I don't know the rules in Nevada, but I've read something that you kind of mentioned. It's almost been outlawed to have a foreclosure. So I'd like to be filled in on, you know, what's changed there, because they're the negative equity capital of the country.
Yeah, and not only is it changed there, but you know, it appears those changes are coming to California.
That's
right?
kind of why I asked the question, because that's important to understand as a business model. You know, the business model we have, you know, could change pretty radically if that happens. So what kind of rule?
So the fundamental issue is this, right? Is the laws that we have around mortgages or deeds of trust is what we really use, right? So I buy a house. And when I get a mortgage, I give my ownership of the house in trust to a trustee. So they have the power to sell the house if I don't make my mortgage payments, right?
Correct.
And that's how the foreclosure process works in California and in Nevada. And, you know, within that, there's these loose terms in the law that say, you know, that there's a beneficiary, right, of the deed of trust, who's, you know, one could assume is the lender, or maybe even you could assume it's the note holder. It's not that specifically spelled out in the law,
right?
Right. It's just, you know, somebody that benefits from receiving this stream of payments is allowed to foreclose. And what they've done in Nevada is they've retroactively changed the law to say that you must prove that that beneficiary actually holds the underlying note, and that all of the paperwork, you know, of assignments and transfers and that, you know, through the history of time have to be shown up front before the foreclosure can occur. You know, the whole point of the foreclosure process is if somebody tries to foreclose on you and you can prove that you've made your payments, that you have the opportunity to come forth and stop the sale. And if the trustee doesn't agree with your proof, you know, you can avail yourself of the courts and you know, get an injunction to stop the sale. And there's plenty of time for that. But instead now they've switched that burden of proof, you know, from the homeowner to show that he has made his payments to the bank to show that they actually have, you know, the power under the deed of trust to collect in a way that was never previously specified. And once that's done is brought a complete halt to foreclosures in Nevada. There are still some foreclosures, but they're all homeowner association liens, which aren't subject to the laws, or they're for loans that are outside of the time frame. There's a time frame to which the law applies.
Wow.
And, you know, so it's really, you know, it's really brought a complete halt to the foreclosure process there. And if those laws pass in California, I'd expect it to do the same here.
Well, what's interesting about that is the unintended consequences going forward of who's going to make a loan in Nevada next.
Well, you know, the government's always going to be crazy enough to make a loan, even if they can't collect, so they have the taxpayer to fall back on. But,
okay.
But, you know, I think the other unintended consequence that Nevada isn't thinking about is, you know, it was only a few months ago that they had, you know, 3,000 homes being sold at foreclosure a month. And that's 3,000 escrows. That's 3,000
yeah.
realtor commissions. That's 3,000, you know, clean out crews going out to work. That's 3,000 homes getting cleaned up and put back on the market. And rather than sitting in foreclosure with an owner that's not going to continue to make repairs, why are they going to continue to make repairs on something they know they're going to lose? So I think they're going to deal with pretty significant economic impacts. It's still a few months out, and I think they're going to deal with, and they don't need any further pain in their economy. And I think they're going to deal with significant blight as homeowners just stop bothering to take care of these properties.
Ronald Reagan had a good quote, the 9 most dangerous words in the English language: I'm from the government and I'm here to help. I kind of wish they would perhaps leave our industry partially alone at this point. But that's what you just said is kind of a scary scenario. And it affects people's lives that have had business models that they thought were going to work. And all of a sudden now they're just dead in the water.
Well, you know, the other thing is look, there clearly is, the world's changed, right? When most of these laws were written around mortgage notes and foreclosure and the rest, I mean, these laws aren't 10 years old. They're, you know, 80 years old, right? These things have been around forever.
Right.
And the world's changed, right? We have computers now.
Sure.
Well, does it really make sense? The whole robo-signing thing drives me nuts.
It does.
Because what they're saying is the person doesn't have personal knowledge. I don't rely on going and looking everything up, right? If I've got my computer system that I've been tracking my invoices and my accounts and my bills in, I rely on that. I don't remember every bill I've paid over the last year. I don't remember every detail. Of course I rely on that computer. I don't have personal knowledge of those things.
Sean,
it's insane.
We got 5 seconds. Thanks for joining us. ForeclosureRadar.com and Sean O'Toole. Worth the visit.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.